My name is Patsy McGonigal, and you are listening to the Breffni Early Show.
Breffni, you come all the way from Ireland for this adventure.
Isn't Breffni Early a real tonic, full of positivity?
It's an amazing story, Breffni, with a wonderful, happy ending.
All of those things on your bucket list though, wouldn't necessarily have led you to do the World Cycle Race.
27 countries, 490 days, 18,000 miles on a bike.
You've decided that's it. You're going to keep giving yourself challenges.
Welcome to episode 26 of the Breffni Early Show, where this week we are, I suppose, oh, I don't know how to describe my guest this week, but former colleague, but also somebody who's an inspiration in the world of Irish sport and has been around for a long, long time, and hugely experienced, has been to the Olympics, is so well respected within the world of sport, and I'm absolutely honoured to have him on the show. Patsy McGonigal, welcome to the Breffni Early Show.
Thank you, Breffni, thank you.
There's so many things I could go in terms of introduction, whether it's Donegal Man of the Year, whether it's all of the various Hall of Fame awards you've had over the years. But we're sitting here in Stranorla, in the twin towns of Stranorla and Ballybuffet, in Finn Valley Athletic Club. And I think I want to start there because I think that's where we're going to end up with talking about your legacy in Irish athletics is probably going to evolve through this building and in the fields around it. But let's go back a little bit further to your own upbringing in Ballybuffet. Tell me a bit about that.
Yes, well, I mean, I'm a Ballybuffet man, really. I was born in a house just opposite Rejection's Hotel. People who come through Ballybuffet would know where Rejection's Hotel is. In those days, there were houses opposite, and that day there was no hospital births were a rarity. So I was born in a house there. I grew up in Ballybuffet and went to a school out in the country called Sheshineal, which is not so much out in the country now, obviously. And that was about a 2 mile walk on a daily basis out and 2 mile back, or depending on how long you took to get home. And from there, my life was a normal life of a boy at primary school in Ireland at that time, living in 1950s. Ballybuffet, you can imagine the variation in the culture of that time as distinct from now. Probably fortunate to live in that period of time. I always feel and I say that it suited me, that type of a background. And then my mother was a chemist, a local chemist. She came here from Inishowen. They were Inishowen people, both my mother and my father. My father was an army officer and was a very talented soccer player, played for Ireland, was at the Olympics in 1948 in London. And, he went, obviously, as an army officer, he was stationed in many of the Western Command outposts like Athlone, Mullingar, Rockhill, Dunree, all these places, some of which are closed now, obviously. And he finished his army career back in Donegal, and that all came about, obviously, because of the troubles back in 69, and he was a Donegal man, he was an Inishowen man, he had played for Derry City, so he was an ideal man to come north, and indeed he became the officer commanding up here. So, and as my book Relentless suggests, he also had a double life as an intelligence officer across the border, which of course the Irish government would deny ever happened, but in actual fact it did happen. And indeed one of the interesting stories about him would be that at one point in that 69 period, he would have recruited Derry lads and they would have been trained in a Fort Dunree, which is out by Buncrana. And the theory and the psychology from the Irish government at that time was that they would control Derry. But things moved so fast in Derry that obviously the provisionals took over in that area of Derry. So basically, but he was very, very key to so many things that went down in Derry at that time. And of course, he was the commanding officer in Donegal. So that was my father, and my mother was the old school Irish mother. You would get a clip in the ear from her very quickly, and she was a disciplinarian, no nonsense. And those days, just again, background of a town at that time, not like now. People didn't rush to the doctor. They tended to go to the chemist, and she was a doctor, chemist, everything, because basically people didn't have the money, and unless it was serious, they didn't head to the doctor. So I grew up in that environment, and I moved from there. Then, Breffni, I went to I went to boarding school. I was a wee shy young fella, in fairness, and I went off about 11 or 12 to boarding school in Derry, in St. Columb's College on Bishop Street, overlooking the Brandywell football ground. And that was tough. That was I was homesick. I was continually homesick. And I found homesickness hard to deal with. And you didn't see your mum too often. And, you know, you didn't get home all that often. But I'm sure when I look back on it now, it formed the character that I was to become. All of those things. Growing up here, going to boarding school, a mother and father who loved you and cared for you, but took no nonsense. And that was pretty normal back then.
I've read your book, Relentless. It's out, I think, last week.
Yes, out just last Monday.
And I had a complete read-through of it last night in one sitting, and it's absolutely captivating from start to finish. Because it's about athletics, yes, and it's about your life, but it's also about the life of growing up in those era of the Troubles, on the border. You talk about how athletes lived on one side of the border here and came to take part in athletics in this venue we're sitting in right now in Finn Valley. And you talk about all those challenges, and there's some really, really good stories about those times. If we go back to your school times in St. Columb's, the two or three things that struck me from the book were how you used to kind of eavesdrop over the wall from into the stadium to watch Derry City games, and you say you did it so often you could nearly pick out who the players were from a distance.
And it was a distance. It actually was a distance. And, of course, it was a Saturday. Irish League that time, Derry City, Irish League. Yes. And it kind of was your whole... A home game for Derry City on a Saturday, just that was brilliant because you had a focus. Now, that focus was, I would imagine, minimum of certainly a half mile away, maybe 1,000 metres, 1,200 metres. And, you know, you can imagine trying to decipher, but you got to know the story so well, and you were looking through a wire fence at these guys. So you watched it, and you did get to know the players, and I couldn't even tell you now how that happened. But certainly that was one of those things. See, there was no pastimes, there was no activities.
Well, you say that, but you found a love of the cinema as well.
And I did. Out. That was an interesting one. Yeah, you know, that was it. Well, you took a serious chance on a Wednesday. We got a kind of a half day for swimming or a Saturday or whatever. So I kind of figured now there was three cinemas in Derry, and you could take a serious chance. It was like, you know, end of the world if you were going to get caught here. But you jumped the wall and you ran down the Lecky Road, and which was made so famous by Phil Coulter and his song "Town I Love So Well" later, and you ran to the cinema. But the funny comical thing about all these films that I went to, I never got to see the end of them because I had to be back in study 4 or 5 o'clock, and if you were late for study, that was a real giveaway. So you took the last second out of at the back of the cinema, and you held on for another second, and then you belted it up the walls of Derry and back in through and jumped the wall and breathless back in to the school. But never caught that, interestingly. And then the other trick that I played to get out, you were allowed out to get a dentist appointment. And being probably cute as time went on, I stole a handful of dentist cards for dental appointments in the dentists, and I wrote my own. And so I was the best looked about inverted commas young fella in the place. But it got me out on an official. I could be seen walking around then in Derry. And I had an aunt, an uncle, and his aunt was a Mayo woman. She used to cook me something to eat, and eating was a problem because the food wasn't great, you can imagine. Boarding schools in Ireland, and I'm not making a big case for me or anybody else, boarding schools in Ireland were absolutely all pretty much all the same everywhere, and you didn't get out. And then, of course, I tell the story in the book about this, the introduction of athletics. And it wasn't really an introduction of athletics. It was a race on the school lawn to see who was the fastest, etc., 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 by a young priest who came along. We were going to have a match against the CBS, the local CBS, and that kind of whetted my appetite unbelievably. And I won the race. That gave me, within the group, you know, in the college, it kind of gave you get confidence in yourself as well. And I suppose from that day on, I wanted to run and be a runner. And you know.
Who were the big influences that you would have seen at the time in athletics?
No, I know there's no background. You see, you're coming out of Donegal, first of all, and there was no organised athletics, zero, absolute zero. I actually tell the story of even years later, late 60s. As far, I was born in 47, so late 60s. I would say, and I tell the story when I talk in schools and places and groups, you could have put all the athletes in the entire county of Donegal into a 14-seater minibus. And we were all running for a club called Cranford, including myself. And, you know, that kept the fire burning in me, obviously. And but there was no athletics. So I had no real influences. I knew about Delaney, obviously, 56. And really, other than that, I didn't really know. We didn't really know a lot, really, you know.
You talk about Delaney, and there's a story in the book about the radio.
Yes.
Was put away for a year.
Yes.
The death in the family.
That was interesting. Yes.
And I found that fascinating that, A, you, as a youngster, about 10 years of age and 57, I think, if memory serves.
I was living with my grandmother then in Inishowen in a house where there was no electric. So they must have had the battery-operated radio. Electrification only came in and around that part of Inishowen about 56, 57. So I tortured them, harped on and on and on. I don't know why that should be. That was better. Delaney was running in a race to the White City, 56, 57 it was, and or whatever, run around that time. And the radio had been turned off because my grandfather had died. And that the tradition was to keep the radio off for the full year and covered over with a tablecloth or a linen sheet or whatever. And they broke the rule and let me listen to this race, and then it was switched off again. And of course my granny was emotional and cried through the whole thing, but I can still remember the fact that the thing was, you know, that it happened that way. So basically, to make a long story short, it was it's an interesting aside in the sense that so why should or would I do that? I have no idea.
It just inspired me.
It inspired me. Another thing that inspired me too now when my memory comes round, as a young boy, I think it might have been 60, John Lawler. John Lawler threw the hammer. And about 150 boys were put into a room, and we were allowed to watch you weren't allowed to watch TV anyway, but they put a black and white television into the college, and we were allowed to watch the thing for this Irish hammer thrower. So I got very excited about, but he finished fourth. John, he died actually recently, John Lawler, but he was in the tradition of the great hammer throwers in Ireland. I didn't know anything about this tradition, but it was a memory.
You talk about finishing school, and this is again in the book, Relentless, and I'm glad you brought it up. You talk in school about moving to England, to Strawberry Hill, or St. Mary's, as we know at the time. And you also talk about meeting Rosalind, your now wife.
Yes.
And those two are very intertwined, and even the birth of your first son.
Yeah.
Like, at that time, in this day and age, it's quite normal for a couple to however they get together, they have a child before they're married. Mm. Back then, that wouldn't necessarily have been the done thing, because you would have, what, maybe 21, 22
20,
years?
20.
Yeah.
I was 19 around that time, and I was a student in London. And I was blessed to get into the college in St. Mary's. And Rosie was pregnant, and she was back here. So obvious thing in my mind was that she would come to London as well. So I dealt with it, you know. Of course it was serious pressure. It was. You have to remember, it was the 60s. So, I mean, it was frowned upon. And I suppose my mother and father, I think what their mentality, they would have been probably embarrassed too, because small Irish towns are what they are. It's kind of relevant conversation now, because there's a big thing going on about the girls and the guards and stuff, and other people ringing on Joe Duffy today that on this particular day that we're talking.
News talk had it on the way up in the car.
Yes, and exactly. And, you know, I dealt with it, you know. But it was serious. It was serious. I mean, I got married in London. The Vincentians were the priests in St. Mary's, and they were all Irish. And I have to say, they were very, very good to me. They were very, very good to me. One of them, Father Cunningham, married us. Of course, nobody at the wedding, only all the Blinken students, and some cousins of Rosie's who were in London. My mother and father were out of their minds, I would say. A woman was going to leave college. I'm sure that was a big concern for them. But I never ever I never contemplated leaving college. So, but I had to get part-time jobs, and it was difficult to get an apartment, or we call it now, but a flat or anything, because the English, particularly in a well-off area like down there, southwest London, they didn't want an Irish guy with a child, basically. And so my way around that was to pile in a whole rig of Irish fellas into a house, and we were part of the story as well. So we just took over a house, you know, and but survived, like, and again, kept running, kept going, come back here in the summertime. There's an intertwine here with the Army and the FCA and all of that, you know, and I was lucky. I would have been able to go on camp staff in Finner Camp for 3 months, maybe in the summer. That gathered me up quite a lot of money. Rosie would have stayed with her mother and father, and we would have stayed there, and I would have made the journey over and back. There was always an answer, I have to say, but all of it, you know, kind of, I just got on with it, you know.
Yeah, and you talk in the book as also about how you weren't at the birth of any of the five kids, but you were there for an athletics meet or for an army event, and you were almost prioritised that over the birth of your kids, or is that fair?
Well, it's probably fair looking back, but it didn't seem to roll out like that for me at the time. I mean, I only had come back to Ireland that weekend because there was an athletics meeting, because I would have had no money to be coming back. And I have to say, in my defence, that men in those days didn't hang around the hospital when babies were born. You know, so there was no remarks passed on it, you know.
Your point is that
you know, I do remember I did drive past the hospital, and Rose was in the hospital, and of course when I came back from Cranford or wherever I was that day after a Cup of Ulster Championship or something, I had another child, but so I followed up on it then, but I had to get back to England again. You know.
I bring it up kind of in jest because we're sitting here in Finn Valley now, and we're joined in the room by a member of your family.
Yes.
Do you want to introduce him?
Yes, Luke. He's not going to speak. No.
You're here with your grandson, and I think that's kind of a common enough theme as well in Ireland, is where maybe fathers who didn't get to spend that much time with their own kids now are almost inseparable from grandkids and spend a lot more time.
Very, very true. I find and I explain to people that I have great time for my grandchildren. I really get very, very close to them, and I can study them and work with them and be supportive of them and spend serious time with them. But I didn't really do with my own, because I was rushing. I was always busy. Still busy, but I'm able to manage it better now as a grandparent, and I love the connection with the grands. Yeah. So it's an apt point, in fairness. Yeah.
You came back to Donegal.
Yes.
And you got your PE qualification.
Yes.
You decided to move back to Donegal. You brought family home.
Yep.
And you started working in what was a pretty non-existent industry there in terms of physical education, teaching. Tell us about the first few years trying to, I suppose, change minds about how PE should be worked in schools.
Well, you see, I was lucky. I was coming out of an English system, and basically, I had a fair grounding in English background PE and practical as well, practical. And I go on the book to say that I think at one point, whether it's relevant now or not, when Thoman got going, and then beyond that, the University of Limerick, which was the first forerunner of physical education beyond that. And the years after that, there was too much emphasis on theory, in my opinion, and to a point, too much emphasis on GAA. And I had a broad remit in my mind. You know, everything I did, everything from boxing to volleyball to bringing fellas out walking to, you know, anything you could think of, a varied PE program, and started athletics, obviously, as well.
Athletics, obviously, is a huge part of your life for the last 50 years in the region. You look at a rural area like Donegal, and I'm from Leitrim next door, and it's very similar. The GAA is super dominant in terms of finances, in terms of people's interest, in terms of volunteer hours, in terms of resources and facilities. To be sitting here in a facility like this with all the modern bars and restaurants and swimming pools and indoor halls, outdoor cages, as well as the running track outside, it's unique, I would imagine, within athletic clubs in Ireland, particularly outside of major, major towns, because Ballybuffet wouldn't, population-wise, wouldn't really be on the map.
I go further, Breffni. I would say it's probably unique even in an European context, you know, because this is an athletic club with become a community hub for all sports, rugby, soccer, boxing, everything out of here, swimming, everything out of here. But the athletic club are the key guys running the show. And that, you know, most facilities like this are either council, university, school, or municipal. Whereas this is, as you say, it's unique in that the place is a small place. But I suppose, you know, I bought a disused factory. First of all, we started in the GAA field, and they were very kind to us, and they let us in, and they allowed us, which was really open-minded of them, they allowed us to develop a long jump pit and a high jump area and all to the side of a practice pitch that they have in McCool Park over there. And I was in the process as well, of course, going back to my PE days. I knew that there needed to be a structure of the sport of athletics was going to go for it. And it just seemed natural for me to do what I did. I got athletic, primary schools athletics going. I got secondary schools athletics going. I started community games, ran it on my own, completely, absolutely, you know, filled in forms and told all sorts of lies about who was secondary treasurer because I hadn't time to call meetings, and I just hammered on. And so I got the ball rolling, you know, in terms of get people into this new sport, as it was. And then 71 to form Finn Valley Athletic Club. So we're back in the Gaelic field, and that's where we started. And then in the 80s, early 80s, a disused factory, which had been a tool factory, Northern Construction owned it. They went into liquidation. The place was sold on to some bankrupt crowd, and I bought it from an English company then. And it was a total run down, no doors, no thing. But I got to just start it. There was a roof. But I only had about 2 acres then. We have about 15 acres around us here now, you know, and I have plans to buy more. But I did, the place that we're sitting in now, I did it bit by bit. I didn't just go at this because that would have beat me. And the other thing that I was very aware of, this, we're talking about the Finn Valley Centre now, as it is now, I've seen people in clubs of various sports going very, very well, and their focus turns to the development of the facilities, and they find it difficult in parallel to keep the two of them running strong, to continue the performance level in the club and all that, and still do the other. So I only managed what I could. So I built bit by bit, you know, and I worked it different ways and got the job done. So it's going to be a great legacy. It is a great legacy for the community beyond me. And I'm proud of the fact that an athletic club was able to do that, you know. Yeah.
Particularly in rural Donegal, the GAA, as I mentioned, absolutely, is such a huge draw. What were the challenges at the time when you come in with this new sport? People have only ever maybe seen or heard about on the radio or seen on television, and all very new, with no real background in the area. What were the main challenges?
There would have been a bit of negativity from the GAA. You know, they were. I would have instances of they would have been. They would never spell it out. Because I would say my personality and profile in the community, they just couldn't take me on one-on-one. But I knew behind the scenes there weren't... Some of them were brilliant. Some of the people within it would have been resentful enough now that, you know, where is he going with his athletics, you know what I mean? But, you know, it really didn't bother me. I didn't even tease it out too much. And, you know, I thought I was the greatest thing since the sliced pan when I was coaching wee 12, 13, 14 year olds to win All-Irelands, and I thought, this is just the most unbelievable. I must be brilliant. And sure, nobody gave a hoot in that community. I used to walk up and down the street thinking, going shopping and things, thinking, I'd say everybody's chatting now about me with them young ones winning the All-Irelands. And sure, I realised years later that nobody gave a hoot.
Yeah, no, nobody really does care if it's outside their own remit or outside their own identity. Has that ever been an issue for you? I know you're quite versed in the media, and you talk about whether it's Highland Radio or whether it's the Pirate Radio and or various media outlets through the book. was that always a priority for you, was to get the message out there, get people just being active and taking part?
Absolutely, absolutely, Brefty. I got very fortunate. One of the local newspapers took me on board on a weekly basis, and I never missed. I rattled out our story every single week, providing photographs back then and all of that, and that was part of the as some of the media machine, you know. And I've done to this day. I still hammer it, you know. I do, as you say, the local radio and all of that, and you know, the social media, and I hammer it out there, you know, because you've got to fight for your sport. You've got to fight for attention for your sport, you know. Not all. You know, people running radio stations and different sports things will give you. You have to demand sometimes and be a bit bullish about it, you know. But that didn't bother me. I was bullish. I got my story in there, you know, because I knew that I needed to have to be Finn Valley. I needed to tell the Donegal story or the Northwest story, because they took great confidence. The athletes took great confidence from that, you know, and you know, they listened for it. And I even got to the point on the local radio of getting down to, you know, look, the real local, you know, where they were actually from, as to, you know, the town land, and that keyed in, particularly in the beginning of local radio. I keyed that in more than I would do now. It's a bigger world now. But 25 years ago, if you mentioned a town land, you know, everybody's going to stop in that small place, and they would be aware of your story. So, no, I was very aware of the media. Still am.
You moved on, obviously, from local matters, and while Finn Valley has been there from the start right through to today, over the last 25, 30 years, you've really branched out to a national and international level, I suppose, various steps in your own career, whether it's with Athletics Ireland, with the Olympic Council of Ireland, with Letterkenny IT, have seen you take on a variety of roles at the national level and representing Ireland at major internationals. And I suppose we look at major sports managers and coaches and administrators, and to be selected as the manager of the Irish team on 68 plus occasions, that's no mean achievement.
You're not counting at the time, but when you look back, it's a pretty big achievement. You know, the tradition was that you would only ever get appointed for one Olympic cycle, you know, or not even only half of the Olympic cycle. You know, I survived and for five Olympic cycles, and was to go on to Tokyo. But I realised after the World Championships 2017 in London that I wasn't as motivated anymore, and I felt, I have three more years left here now, and, you know, what's ahead of me? Well, it was Doha for starters, and there's stuff like that, and I just thought, I'll back off here. I'm going to back off, and I'm happy that I did, because, all right, like, I mean, I was on the ground. I was good even to the bitter end, but at the end of the day, Brefney, it was like, how would you say, it wasn't exciting me to the point that it should have been, and it was good. I was glad it stepped down then. But anyway, I started in 92. With the junior team under 20, that was way to Seoul in South Korea, and then moved on to junior again. But in the interim, I was doing junior on the 20s, and I was doing cross country, and I was doing, you know, all of those. I was doing every aspect of the sport.
Can you explain to me and the listeners how? Because if you look at soccer, Mick McCarthy is the Irish manager, and he's full time. That's his only job. He gets paid handsomely for it, and he's responsible for everything. On the rugby side, Joe Schmidt is the same, and that's what people's perceptions are. But the team manager isn't necessarily that you're the blanket 100% decision maker. There is selection committees.
No, there would be selection committees.
But there are also other managers that would step into various events that maybe you might be unavailable for.
Exactly.
Because it's not your full-time job.
No, I'm a volunteer. And, you know, I never got paid. Ever, and through all of that period, I never got paid. People used to say to me, "Jeez, Patsy, they should pay you," but I kind of went in at a time when volunteerism was the issue, big deal. So there was no point in me changing the story. I was just so privileged to be managing the team. And, you know, there were other people who were impacting on some of the decisions in terms of coaching sometimes. So there was another way of control in that. I got in as, I was chair of coaching point in Irish Athletics. I was chair of high performance. So I had my thumb seriously on it, you know. So I wasn't going to tolerate a lot of nonsense, you know. So I did dictate the pace. I did dictate the pace to the point where I'm sure I annoyed many people. But it was always driven by the view, we've got to get the best. Do you know what I mean? Right now, of course, there's a performance manager in there. There's a performance lead in there, getting obviously well paid. But I have no problem with that now. I felt in time that's the way it had to go anyhow. And that's the way it has gone now. But no, I had a great period. And, you know, I described the period of starting to manage the national team and the great honour and then going to the Olympics. I used to say things like, I would drive at 120-130 miles an hour to get to the airport. I was that excited. Whereas in the end, 3 or 4 days out from departure, I was thinking, do I need this? You know what I mean? And that wasn't good. So just an experience, you know.
Was it the sport or was it everything around the sport? Because we've both been away with international teams, major multi-sports events, and there's a lot more than just getting on a flight, going, taking the event. There are long periods of time. The Olympics could be 2, 3, 4 weeks away from home, away from work, away from family. There's also that politics that we talked about, internal within sports, within organisations, inter-organisational politics, particularly in Irish sport. There's so many different people involved, whether it's the sports council or whatever. What exactly was it did you fall out of love of the sport, or did you fall out of love of the politics of sport, if that makes sense?
I suppose I fell out of love with, I think it wasn't just one thing, you know, and probably it was me as well, and maybe, you know, age was coming into it as well, you know, so that might be, I would say it was a combination of stuff, you know. I can't complain, you know, because when I was running the show, I was running the show. In the end, last 12 months or so, possibly I wasn't running the show to the same extent, but that, you could say it didn't suit me really. But then people would say, well, Patsy, it had to move on. And I emphasise, I had no problem with that, and I wish everybody the best of luck. But I had to deal with serious politics during my period, and I was a very assertive, strong personality, so obviously I was in a wire zone some of the time. But I felt justified, and, you know, I had some good people stood with me and others who ran as far away as they could from me because they didn't want to be on side with me. And there was all of that, you know, but I used to kind of explain, probably that goes on in a lot of sport in Ireland, you know, so I don't think we were actually, maybe I don't know, I have no knowledge for saying this, but I'd say there's a lot of that goes on, you know, and I've found over the years, I mean, with some of the other Olympic sports, I was watching within, you know, because we two together, and I found they had troubles as well, you know.
I think everybody has it.
Yeah.
I suppose. Our paths were crossed when I spent time...
University sport.
With university sport. Yeah. I was there for 5 years. You were one of the voluntary... you weren't actually on the board, but you were floating around the board, if that made sense.
That's right, yeah.
And you were always there at the end of the phone if we needed help because of your experience.
Yeah.
I remember one day... I would have had similar situations in that organization.
Yeah.
And I think everybody I've ever spoken to has had similar organizations, some to different scales. Where it works, it seems to work very well. Where it doesn't, it tends to just stay stagnant, which in the world of sport, as you know yourself, means you fall behind. What do you make of the situation that Irish sport is going in at the moment with the scandals and the FAI and I suppose the things that's been happening over the last 3 or 4 years in the OCI, do you see Irish sport maybe kind of, I suppose, wiping the slate clean, and is this an opportunity for it to start again, or do you think that's going to happen?
Well, it's again, unless you're in the middle of it, unless you're absolutely in the middle of it, it's very hard to comment, you know, about what is actually going on, and I haven't been in the middle of it now for a couple of years, you know, to be honest, Brethany. So I always say, you know, outside looking in, you form an opinion that may not be relevant and may not be to the point. So I kind of stay away from that. But is it going to be any better? I can talk from my own sport. I just think athletics won't move on to the point that I would like to see it moving on until they get a grip of the coaching element of it. Coaching is poor within clubs. I, you know, within clubs, and lead money needs to be spent on lead on different technical areas. There needs to be serious money spent, and you know there needs to be to a point. They need to regionalise. They need to have regional squads that are meaningful. And I say the word meaningful. You know, there's a lot of ticking boxes going on in sport, and they're bringing people together. And then they say, "Oh, we had a squad session today." I stopped sending my athletes to squad sessions a long time ago in Ireland, in Irish athletics, because it was a waste of time. You know, there was very little going on, and you know they were just tittering about, and there was no, and you know it wasn't the coaches. The direction wasn't there to drive it forward and keep the contact going, and to use the resources of the best coaches. There was a parochial element to it as well. I mean, I put out a thing here in Donegal about a year ago and said, you know, we should be sending the best clubs, the best athlete, young athletes, in each of the clubs to the coach that has the most knowledge, regardless of club. And everybody thought that was off my head, and you know, joked with me about it, and flippantly said, "What's wrong with Patsy? He's losing it." Like, but you know, I see that unless we do something like that. You know, I could have a good hammer thrower, and if there's a good hammer thrower 20 miles down the road, hammer grip, somebody that knows something about hammer, then send my boy down, you know, because you're going to lose him. You're going to lose. So that coaching thing is poor within athletics. The lead. Now, the participation levels have gone through the roof. That's massive. I'm staying on athletics for a minute, Breffni. I'm not a mad fan of park runs.
I was going to ask you about this because it's the one thing.
Oh, I know.
And I kind of get where you're coming from, but it has driven participation through 100%. The roof, like you mentioned.
Absolutely, and I'm totally with that. And I see all the positive elements of the park runs, 100%. It's a great, great idiom. It's a great outlet. It's so positive. But I feel that the mistake was made not linking it in with organised club or some overview in a more meaningful way, so that there was a pyramid to the whole thing, and that the clubs were gaining. Now the park runs at the minute, the people are gaining, and that's brilliant. It's mentally, socially, physically positive, but the sport of athletics, you know, there's a selfish nature to it. Yeah. Now I say selfish because I'm a club man. I'm traditional athletics. So if you were a parkrun person listening to this, they would say, "Well, Patsy just doesn't get this parkrun thing." I get the parkrun thing. I think it's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. But I feel there was more in it for athletics if it had been thought through a bit better.
Yeah, I think your point in the book was, or maybe I misread it, was that you've all these people showing up on a Saturday morning to run at no cost.
Yeah.
And yet your facilities like we're sitting in right now.
Yeah.
And you can't provide that without the structure of a club, because something like Park One, where nobody contributes anything, it's not going to be sustainable when maybe that fad wears off, or when the sponsorship runs out. Or
well, my reference, Brittany, is England. My reference is England, and I have a fellow who was formerly Finn Valley Athletic Club. He's the secretary in Essex, and he has experience. He's at a club, and his experience would be park runs. The outcome of park runs for him as a club means that people won't turn out on the Saturday and Sunday to run for the club, because they just suit themselves. Fair enough, that's what they want to do, and you can't argue against that. But for me, the traditional guy who grew up in the club scene, it doesn't work for me, you know.
Yeah. Let's talk about the Olympics for a little while, because you have worked with the list of athletes you've worked with is just phenomenal the whole way down the line. Some probably more hands-on than others. Who are the athletes that you've worked with that you would feel you've had the best relationship with in terms of watching them develop into what they had the potential to be?
All right. Well, I tended to have good relationships, full stop, you know, with athletes, and some were, so they, all of them produced different challenges, obviously, because of the nature of them. And people need to remember that a lot of these kids, as they were at the beginning, were dreaming dreams and putting their life on hold to get to the Olympic Games, to get qualifying standards, to get performances. And I could relate to all that. And I supported them. Obviously, in the very beginning, Sonia kicked in very clearly, very much. She was a big story. She was a big Irish sports story. and, you know, carried us through. And I actually thought at the time, I remember coming out of Sydney and beyond, that Lord save us, when Sonia's career's over, we're in trouble, you know. But Lord, along came David Gillick, along came Dervil O'Rourke, and, you know, they, you know, to just, and then Rob was coming through, and Rob Heffernan, and they were coming through. I had a great relationship with Rob, a great relationship with David Gillick, and Sonia, eventually, you know, because it took a time to develop, because she was out, she wasn't in Ireland, she was out of Ireland the majority of the time. But, you know, we had great, I also had got good reaction for things like European Cup, you know, where initially when I came in the early 90s, the American athletes wouldn't come home because they were at war with athletics in Ireland all the time, with the personalities of Irish athletics at the time, so they just wouldn't come home. I had to change that mindset, you know, and in 1994, I changed it, and one European Cup meet, they came home, and I kind of kept it rolling. And I made a big deal of it, and I made a bit of time and effort and phone calls and contact and communication into it. Out of Donegal, on your normal phone or whatever kind of way you could manage it, ringing them up at 6 o'clock in the morning, you know, before they get out of bed, before they go to work, just to develop, you know, just let them know that I know you're there, you know, we think a lot about you. You know, I think you could do this, you could do that. And that actually impacted to the point where some athletes eventually re-engaged to the point where they got to the Olympic Games that they might never have gone to, you know, because they believed in me, you know. But I certainly believed in them. You know, I just so admired what they did. And, you know, and I just was a big enthusiast for them and fought for them. You know, those were some people. Then more recently, Kieran McGean was a delight to work with, and so on. Mark English was local, obviously. I had coached his aunt, and she was a national senior champ, a medalist in 200, over 200 metres, which was 16. And, you know, had a developed relationship with the family, so that was very nice to have. Brendan Boyce was another boy who's in this club here, Finn Valley, and, you know, he's working hard towards his third Olympic Games. And, you know, those are just some of the people that are names, but, you know, I also am very quick to point out, Bethany, that it really wasn't always about the named athletes that people would recognise. It was actually about just everybody. Yes. It was about everybody.
I've been in selection committees with you around the World University Games.
Yes.
I know I was in Bangkok in 07 and Belgrade in 09, and I know you did the first two or three of that decade in probably Daegu, Izmir, and somewhere else.
I did, yeah, I can't
remember. Memory escapes me right now.
Beijing. It was in Beijing as well, I think.
Yeah. In 01. And so you had this wave of success at that level, and it just carried right through in terms of the likes of Eilish McSweeney, who until recently was the fastest woman in the country. She won an individual and a relay in Izmir.
And Anna Boyle, who took the record off her, was there as well, you know, on the 100. We had a good championships.
Emily
University.
Maher,
Emily Maher, great girl, went to the Olympics with me. That was Izmir was the icing on the cake. World University Games. I loved the University Games, and I loved working with guys like yourself. But you know what it was as well. You know, I liked the multi-sport camp. I liked the multi-sport event. You know, which was obviously replicated in the Olympic Games and all that. You know, and you touched. And I'm jumping off here, but you touched about my finally leaving the sport in the national team and not going through to Tokyo. Time away from home, eventually, I just felt, nah. You know, there's a loneliness to it, you know. There's a loneliness to it. People think it's an exotic away. Actually, all you see is the track, the place you're staying in, where you eat, and you might go for a walk down the street in the evening. End of story.
No. If you're very unlucky, you'll see lots of hospitals as well.
Well, you will too. You will too. And injuries.
100%. I was in Bangkok at the World University Games in 07, and I didn't see a single temple or a market for a month.
No.
And anyone who's ever been to Bangkok, you can't walk down the street. I don't think we got out one night.
No.
I think I actually did get out one night with Niall, your son, actually.
Yeah.
Was one of the coaches there.
Yes, that's
right. And we went into the city for a night.
Yeah.
We lasted about an hour. We were both shattered. We came home.
Yeah.
It was...
Yeah. No, it's not... It isn't what people...
No.
It's not a holiday, you know. It's not a holiday.
No, and it's the 18-hour days.
Yeah. And if there's anything goes wrong, you got to stick with the story. You know, you can't fake off, you know.
What are your highlights? I know you talk again, keep referencing the book, but it's just so fresh, and I read it yesterday. You talk about Rob Heffernan post, I think it's London, and the iconic photograph of him sitting on that
air conditioner,
yeah. And you just put your foot up, yeah. Just chatting to him. Mm. It's how do you deal with someone who, even though he's finished fourth in the world, which by any standards is a phenomenal achievement, there is that psychological thing of going, I didn't get a medal for this, even though he subsequently did. How do you deal with the disappointment of that and helping an athlete through that?
You can't be educated for that. It's either something that rolls with you, and through experience, I suppose, as well. And, you know, you couldn't say, this is the way I'm going to deal with this until it happens. And then you either deal with it or you don't, you know. I had very, very, very successful club teams, particularly women's club teams here. We won 11 or 12 national senior women's cross-country team titles. I started these girls when they were kids, and we went to European Cup every single year throughout Europe. And you know, I loved life with them every single day, and they had their disappointments in life as well as sport. I was learning all the time. I went with Donegal for two different periods, and we had disappointments.
That's in Gaelic football.
Yeah. And I went with Donegal on two occasions in the noughties and in the 90s. And there was success. There was National League finals. There was All-Ireland semi-finals. There was all of that. But there was. You're learning all the time from different walks of life, you know, from, you know, just so many. I mean, in the book I quote, you know, I'm under pressure in Sydney, and... You know, I'm under pressure in Sydney, and Tom O'Riordan, who was a revered journalist with the Ian O'Riordan, now writes for the Irish Times, his dad asked me, so you feel you're under pressure, Patsy? And my answer very directly, immediately was, no, I'm under no pressure here. You want to be in Clonus at half-time, and you're a couple of points down at half-time, and the water bottles start flicking flying, and you're the boy that's doing the psyching up, and you're the boy that's trying to settle it down, you're the boy that's trying to get them back out on the field. And in those days, there was no cameras about going back out on the field. You went out through the door nearly. So basically, and I was good at that kind of stuff. And, you know, so that was all that was learning for that day, probably, in London. And I had a very strong relationship with them anyway. So... But, you know, nobody would understand the effort that a boy like that would have put into over the years, the sacrifices he would have made, the, you know, it's just, you couldn't put it even in writing, you couldn't express it, you know, training camps in the Sierra Nevada Mountains and in Morocco, away from your family, away from home. And he had been doing this since we were back in Sydney together, you know. We had been to every Olympics together, everywhere. And every major championship, European, Worlds, everything. And, you know, then he gets to London and he has a chance. And a doper from Russia beats him. And you know that he's doping. And he's crying. And you're there. And I can't even remember even... I do know I remember saying to him... I remember I used one line. Immediate line to him was, listen, Rob... it's not over yet. This is not over, you know. And I kept saying, this is not over. And I tried to convince the journalists, the Irish journalists who were on the mall that day, that it wasn't over, but nobody was interested in listening. I remember that very well. I said, lads, this is not over. Is somebody going to deal with the fact that this is not over? To give him some, but nobody referenced the fact that it wasn't my view that it wasn't over. And luckily enough, it wasn't over, and he did get his medal, and I went to Cork and was there when he got his medal. And maybe it was even better the way it happened in his own place, you know, in a big occasion in the City Hall. But his massive, unbelievable achievement was Moscow, on the banks of whatever the name of the river is. And you know, man, you know, to get out there, to take the Russians on in Moscow, to hit the front, you're eating your nails, you're running, you're driving them on, you're thinking, can he stay there? What had happened? And it happens, and he's the world champion. And, you know, that was a massive, massive, massive occasion for him, you know, and for me, obviously, being there.
Yeah. In that same race, not in Moscow, but back in London, in the 50-kilometre walk, my countryman, Colin Griffin, was also at that event, disqualified.
Yes.
Had some horrendous luck. That's a very different situation. And is that the same? Do you have to talk to someone like that who's maybe not performed because Rob had set a 7 minute PB that day. Like, by any stretch of the imagination, medals aside, it was the most phenomenal performance of any Irish athlete, probably at those games, with the exception maybe of Katie Taylor. And you have, Rob has done, but I think relatively Katie went with expectation. Rob probably didn't have the same level of expectation.
Well, he didn't have the same awareness, you know?
Yeah.
He wouldn't have the same awareness with the general public.
But someone, because athletics gets hammered at times, wrongly, in my opinion, for not making finals and not winning medals. And the reality is, we look at sports like rugby, for example, where there's really only seven or eight clubs or countries in the world are going to win the World Cup this year. You go into athletics, every single child of Luke's age who's running around us here runs 100 metres at some point. So you have this huge base around every country in the world, all clamouring to get to the Olympics, and you have thousands of athletes of an international standard looking for that spot. To finish in the top 20 or 25 is a phenomenal achievement.
Phenomenal. It's phenomenal. But, you know,
yet we don't seem to understand this.
Well, television drive winners, don't they? Television drives and gives expectations. I'm only talking about winners. So basically, that's what you got to deal with. You know, 206 or 208 countries, and they're all represented at the Olympic Games or World Championships. So, you know, that's how global the sport is. And your point is very, very apt, you know, about global nature of sport and different sports. And yet we take great pride in the rugby. We take great pride in the ball. I know that. Yeah. I know that. But athletics, it is, you know, I suppose we have had the odd sprinkling of great success, and we still live in hope as we continue to drive forward, you know. I wouldn't be as hopeful, you know, right now, but look, you never can tell. But it was during my time, there was always somebody that you could pin something on. That was always important as well, you know, because the general public were always going to be interested in your athletic story, because your athletics team story, because you had somebody in the team that was going to impact. Obviously, Thomas Barr doesn't do it going forward. Then where do you go? Where do you go?
I don't know the answer to that.
I'm asking myself. Yeah.
I'm a big believer in systems producing results rather than this ad hoc thing of whether you want to go back to Irish history and look at Ronnie Delaney or look at Sonia Sullivan or look at other people. They tend to have been very self-motivated. Even Rob Heffernan, we've talked about a good bit, would have been very self-motivated. He'd have been organising his own camps and battling for everything he got from the system. And the amount of money that's involved in some of these athletes, like you take someone, like, I'm not going to speak specifically, even though it is published, I don't know, but I would imagine Brendan Boyce is somewhere around that either 12,000 range or 20,000 range. Probably at the 12, because he hasn't medaled at a major games. For him to get to the level where he realistically can compete at a major games, he needs more than €250 a week to cover his living expenses and all his competition costs. Because if he has to get to Brussels next week for a game or for a meet, he has accommodation, he has food, he has flights, he has all of that stuff. And that's Brussels, which is a Ryanair flight away, which might be less than €100. If he has to get to the far side of Russia or Japan or South Africa or Argentina for a meet, it makes it much, much more difficult, completely impossible, really, without relying on the bank of mum and dad, the bank of friends and family. And all of a sudden, they run dry fairly quick when you're trying to fund an elite program. No. What changes would you make with the resources that are there at the moment? Would you be...
There are statistics out there that would suggest that money makes a difference. You know, from major countries that are spending money on athletes and on performance plans. Brendan Boyce, he's only two athletes at this moment in time, as we sit here, have qualification for the Olympic Games. Boyce and Alec Wright. So basically, Boyce gets, as of the last week, gets 12,000 a year. Now, 12,000, you know, isn't going to make him. So he's dependent on family support. He's dependent on club support. He's dependent on everything. So that's not good enough, really. That's not good enough. So yes, there needs to be more money. There needs to be more money to support those kind of guys right through. They're going to need to get the money over a period of years. You just don't throw the money after they've qualified. They they need the money when they're developing into positions. So there needs to be really meaningful money in the development of going forward, and there needs to be reality. There's a lot of nonsense going on right now on Facebook. There's a lot of social media heroes out there now. And it's probably going on in every sport. I'm not being specific to athletics, but everybody's telling everybody they're brilliant, and you know, what is brilliant like? I mean, you know, if it's going on at every walk of life, it's going on every day in all aspects of life, and you know, there's somebody needs to jump in and give the reality check to people, and that's apt for athletics as well. So you know, don't lose the run of yourself. You know, keep the feet on the ground, know exactly where you stand, and just because somebody put some bullshit up on Facebook, don't believe your own hype or their hype for you. So I'm very much on that line, you know.
I'm guessing you're not a fan of participation medals, if reading into that.
Well, how do you mean participation medals?
Like someone goes out and runs a 10K this week, they get a medal at the
end. Well, no, that's a different game. We're talking about a different level. Good luck to them. If that's what motivates them, good luck to them. That's a participation game. You know, if we're talking elite sport, performance sport, that's what I was referenced there. And the participation thing, good luck. The only problem with participation, I find the 5Ks, the 10 thing, is the people who are reacting don't understand. And they're telling fellas that are running 35, 36, 37 minutes for 10K that they're brilliant. And you know, back in the day when there was none of all this mad participation, if you weren't in around 30 minutes, 31 minutes, you weren't going to make a good club team back then. And people were trying to dismiss that, but that is a fact. I know from my teams that I won Ulster with here, won medals in National Senior Cross Country with here, that, you know, there's fellas now, you know, good luck to them. I need them. It's brilliant. If I hadn't got them, I'd be struggling, and they're dedicated. But for some reason, back 15, 20 years, the even at a club level, those who were on board were either more dedicated, lifestyle was different, the demands might have been different. I don't know, but there was a difference back then. And I think it's got a lot to do with lifestyle, and it's got a lot to do with where we live in Western Europe and how life has got softer and stuff, you know.
How has the migration away from rural Ireland affected a club like Finn Valley?
No, it has affected surely, because they're going to have to go away for university and stuff, and you know, you're going to lose that contact that you had. I know it does affect you. It does, you know, it does. But you can't dwell on it too much. You know, you just gotta believe in what you're doing and go on with it. Because if you think too far ahead, you'll get exasperated completely. So. And then you hope that if they do go away, that they might continue and do stuff, you know. But then, if the systems aren't in the universities to lead, then you can't. What are they going to do? You know, there aren't very many universities taking it on. And my world of athletics, now, they would argue that they are, but they really aren't. You know, there's no lead. I mean, all right, middle distance. But middle distance, I mean, to be honest with you, middle distance now is dominated by East Africans and distance. It's not, you know, it's not. We aren't what we were in middle distance athletics. So, it's time to go with jumpers and hopefully other people and other stuff. You know, I don't know. You know, just but anyway, the universities aren't. In general, there are some positive elements, but it isn't widespread. You know.
When you mentioned universities, you just reminded me of something that was in the news-ish a couple of weeks ago in relation to DCU, who would have been the main pushers of university sports in athletics specifically.
Absolutely.
And the work that Enda Fitzpatrick has done there over the last 10 or 12 or 15 years.
Yes.
And recently, I think it was an admin thing. I'm not quite sure what it's come of that. You might know more about it than I would. But Enda was let go from the role because of a legality in the employment
department.
But they were to rehire that position. Yeah, like they would have been the absolute.
They were the
gold
leaders.
Standard.
They were the leaders. They were the leaders. I don't know what the background to that position is. It seems a backward step to me. You know, it's adding on. lead people in the world of athletics that they should be doing, you know, because they've got serious numbers up there, you know. So, I mean, you know, but, and if you don't have a very healthy inter-varsity athletic scene, it isn't good either, you know. And this is where, on occasion, I would tell people, go to the States. Go to the States. Because there's more to the States than the athletics. There's a big education out there, you know, and a big world. So, you know, there's pitfalls with that too, but, you know, in all honesty, I would still be a bit of a believer in the States.
Because of the programs?
Because of the programs, because of the opportunity, because of the education, because of the getting away from Ireland, because of the getting away from Ireland, coming back, and, you know, but it doesn't work for everybody, but I'm just saying, it is an opportunity.
In terms of you moving forward, you've retired from Athletics Ireland, although I'm sure you'll still be a regular at athletics tracks up and down the country. What's next for Patsy McGonigal?
Well, it's just keeping this place going, Finn Valley. You know, I'm the chairman. I'm in a voluntary capacity here, but I call myself the team leader to a point here at Finn Valley. In Finn Valley currently is about 50 people employed, some part time, about maybe 8 or 9 part time. But other than that, there's about 50 people employed in the overall context, and we're open 7 days a week, 6 o'clock in the morning to 12 o'clock at night. And if there's a party at the weekend, sure, you wouldn't know what time it would end. So basically, you know, this is a big focus for me. I also am massively involved in schools athletics. I drive a massive program of primary schools athletics. I employ coaches to go into the schools out of Finn Valley. We go into the schools, we lead programs in all, you know, engaging schools and all things from fastest child to the cross country, to track and field, you know, sports hall. We lead it all in, and I have about 90 schools involved in that throughout the year. So I'm fighting my corner for athletics out of Finn Valley without any support. And that's been very successful. I have actually pretty much 4 coaches out in the schools right now. And that's a big undertaking for me. And, you know, and Finn Valley and the day-to-day athletics, you know, and all the logistics that goes with a massive building like this, you know.
At the end of every show, we ask our guest, if they'd one ask of the person listening to this episode, what would you ask them to do?
Take opportunity. You know, not every day, but people all continually, growing up and in life, there's opportunities, you know, out there, and, you know, people are letting them pass them by. My example of my life has been about a young boy who got an opportunity to run in a race on the lawn of Bishop Street in Derry, and he ran with that opportunity all his life. The biggest regret in my life is not related to athletics at all, is that I'm not able to engage through the Irish language in an interview fluently. Whereas, you know, Irish was bit onto me both at secondary school, and at one point I was fluent, but the fact that spoken Irish isn't, the emphasis isn't on it, I found that I lost it. And there are so many times I would just love to be able to. So that would be a regret, and I would be totally away from my life or athletics or anything else or other things that I've done in my life. You know, I think they've made such a mess of the Irish language in this country. Just to say that, that's a regret. But the message, positive message, is take an opportunity, have a go. Have a rattle. Have a go. You know, you can do stuff. It doesn't matter. I'm from Balbuffet, and this is a small town, and we have a facility and an environment here that you'll be proud of in a major city. So, you know, it can be done, but you need serious drive and a couple of really strong, good, positive people around you.
Patsy, it's been an absolute pleasure to spend the last hour or so with you and Luke, who is looking like he's getting a bit tired now at this stage. Your book, Relentless, is out now.
Yes.
People can get it on Amazon or probably locally in bookshops.
E-book, exactly. E-book, Kindle and Amazon and all that. Yeah.
As it comes out.
Yeah.
It's been lovely spending time in your company again after about 8 or 10 years.
That's right. That's right.
But thank you very much.
Thank you, Breffni. And I'm delighted to meet up with you again.